A very good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. This is the show every Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio as part of Faith Explored that helps you to think through your faith by bringing Christians and non-Christians together. Got a wonderful discussion coming up for you today between Alistair McGrath and Colin Blakemore. If you want to find out more about Unbelievable though and explore the vast back catalogue of episodes via the podcast and online, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable is the place to go, and you can find lots of other good stuff there too. For instance, this year's Unbelievable Conference on DVD and MP3 CD, and available as a digital download, all now available from the Premier Shop. Links there though from the Unbelievable website. And of course, more news about Unbelievable the book. This is the story of the show and why, after 10 years of talking with atheists, I'm still a Christian. Available now. Wonderful to report that the book's now gone to its first reprint, just over a month since release. So it's wonderful to know that people are getting hold of it, and it's available, of course, via Amazon, but also at our own website, unbelievablebook.co.uk. Later on in the show, I'm going to announce who has won the 5 signed copies of the book that I put out a call for on air a few weeks ago. So listen out for that a little later on. And another competition for a book that you'll hear about later on in today's programme. Straight after Unbelievable this afternoon between 4 and 5, you can hear George Verwer on The Profile. I'll be speaking to him. He's one of the most influential missionaries in the world, the founder of Operation Mobilisation. Be talking about his own conversion and some of the struggles he's dealt with in his own life. The Profile, of course, available as a podcast too on iTunes or whichever way you get your podcasts. So lots to look forward to this Saturday afternoon. Lots of feedback to the abortion show from last week as well, where I brought an ex-abortionist and a pro-abortion doctor together for a debate. Goodness me, that's created a flood of emails. We'll try and get to as many of those towards the end of today's show as we can. And of course, I'll be giving you the ways to get in touch as we go through today's programme. Let's get into our subject. You're unbelievable. Well, today on the programme, we're asking, can science, God, or both explain the quest for human meaning? Alistair McGrath's new book, The Great Mystery, draws on both religion and science to explore human nature, especially our quest for meaning in life. Alistair McGrath is the Andreas Idrios Professor of Science and Religion at Oxford University, and as a former atheist biologist turned Christian theologian, he sees God and science as complementary rather than competing explanations for our existence and nature. So does the awe and wonder impressed on us by our scientific understanding of the universe have its roots in something beyond the physical universe? And joining us for today's show is a distinguished scientist, Colin Blakemore, Professor of Neuroscience and Philosophy in the School of Advanced Study, University of London, and Emeritus Professor of Neuroscience at the University of Oxford. Colin is an atheist himself and has championed the public understanding of science, especially in regard, of course, to neuroscience and the brain, with a well-known book such as The Mind Machine. But what does he make of Alistair's synthesis of science and religion in the quest for human meaning? Can it all be explained ultimately in terms of the brain, or is there room for God? I'm really looking forward to engaging both these gentlemen on this question today. So it's a great joy to welcome you both. Thank you for joining me, Alistair and Colin.
Good to be here.
Yes, hello.
Great to have you with me. Colin, you're on the line from your office. Alistair joining me in studio today. Before we come to you, Colin, Alistair, great to have you back. It's not been that long since we were in the studio together talking with another interesting scientist, Jim Al-Khalili, about your previous book, Inventing the Universe. In some ways, the Great Mystery, a sequel in many ways to that book.
Yes, it is. I mean, it's basically just saying, look, there seems to be something about us as human beings that makes us think meaning is really important. Where does that come from? Where does that take us? How does science fit in? How does religion fit in? And actually, my own Christian views are very clear in the book, but I'm trying to open up a wider discussion about why this is so important. And actually, just exploring whether science or religion could have a meaningful dialogue about these things, given that they're both so important in our culture.
It's certainly something that many people are writing about these days. There are all kinds of self-help books that help people to get through life at some level. But you're kind of exploring it from more than just a sort of functional aspect, but sort of the bigger kind of meaning with a capital M kind of question.
Well, I think it's very clear that meaning, whether you have a capital M or a little M, actually is very, very important to people in helping them cope with life. I mean, my question would be, is there some bigger picture which might actually give us a sense of meaning in some deeper sense, which then fits into the kind of situations we face. If you look at someone like Crystal Park, for example, I mean, she would say this sort of, that we look for global patterns of meaning, which then may have local embodiments. In other words, this is how it works in this situation, but there's something bigger that lies behind it.
Many people talk about science answering that how questions, and perhaps religion and philosophy helping us with the why questions. Is that the sort of distinction that you would lend to the question?
I think that does need a lot of nuancing, but there's something in it. I mean, I fully accept that we need to explore questions, how things happen. But there is this deeper question as to whether there's a why. And obviously one of the questions we've got to ask is whether a why question is simply a disguised how question. Mm. And that's certainly something I expect we'll be talking about this morning.
Indeed. It's great to welcome on to the programme Colin Blakemore. Colin, I've wanted to have you on for ages, actually, because I'm aware of your work, and I know many of our listeners will be fascinated to hear what you have to say on the programme today. Alistair is here as a Christian, and I'm sure he can tell us a little bit of the story of how that came to be. Have you always seen yourself as an atheist? Is that something you consciously adopted at any point in your past history?
I grew up in, I suppose, a conventional, somewhat lapsed C of E family, so I certainly didn't think of myself an atheist until I started, I suppose, in the teenage years to think about a lot of other issues. I think the coincidence of my getting interested in science and getting doubtful about religion was more than just a coincidence, and I suppose I fall into that, you know, category of rather predictable physicalists who came eventually to wonder why we need other sorts of explanations. Mm. That science does a very good job, and it's our responsibility as scientists to pursue that cause. And writing God into the equation, just in my opinion, and I'm sure we'll discuss this, makes it more difficult to be a straightforward scientist.
Okay, that's interesting. I mean, what particularly prompted your own interest in pursuing neuroscience as opposed to any other particular discipline?
Well, you know, when I started, which was, of course, a century ago, neuroscience didn't exist as a discipline. People, of course, had been interested in how the brain works for at least 2,500 years, but hadn't sort of put it in those terms. But the recognition that neuroscience is a discipline with a shared goal, even though it might be chemists, physiologists, anatomists, and pharmacologists, physicists, computational scientists, whatever, who are contributing to it, that realization came really in the middle of the 1970s. And I was a medical student in Cambridge in the 60s, in the early 60s, and got interested in vision, in how vision works. And the obvious route to tackling that question was what was then called neurophysiology. People don't use that word very much these days. It's just part of the mishmash of neuroscience. Mm. So I started as what I would have called myself a physiologist. I worked on vision, got interested in the psychology of vision, realized the link between those two components of neuroscience very early on. But the recognition that I was a neuroscientist would have been difficult without the word existing. So it was really in the 1970s when there was this sort of common coming together of many people who set a kind of common goal of trying to understand how behavior is determined by the brain.
Mm. Well, that's great to hear the journey that took you to this place. I mean, has your studies ultimately convinced you that we can more or less explain, you know, the reasons we have maybe even ideas about religion and God by simply looking at the physical processes of the brain and how it came to be?
If I could explain that, then, you know, you could close the book and say, well, we don't need to investigate anything anymore. Of course not. I mean, to suggest that present ignorance is a reason to abandon the quest for understanding and explanation is, you know, clearly a philosophy of despair. No, of course I can't explain everything about how the brain works and how the mind is created by the brain, but my starting point for thinking about how to approach that problem is the approach which is essential to science, and that is a physicalist, causalist, materialist underpinning hypothesis about how things happen in the world. So in other words, I believe that there are explanations possible. They might be in terms of mechanisms that we don't currently know about or understand, but when we find them, they will fit the general explanatory pattern that science has delivered to us so magnificently in other areas of mystery.
Well, look, I'm really looking forward to the conversation you're going to have today then with Alistair Colin. Thank you for joining us on the line. Alistair, I'm looking forward to what you have to say. The Great Mystery is published by Hodder and Stoughton, and we've actually excitingly got two signed copies of the book to give away on the programme today. Not something we get to do that often on the show, but to be in with a chance of winning one of these signed copies of Alistair's book, just tweet or Facebook or email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, with your answer to the very easy question, what is the meaning of life? And if you can do that in 140 characters or less, even better. Okay, so send that in to me. You can find us on Facebook, of course, facebook.com/unbelievablejb, or tweet @unbelievablejb, email in with your answer to that question, what is the meaning of life, to be in with a chance of winning one of these two signed copies that we've been given by the publisher. Again, the website, if you want to find out more about my guest on the programme today and add your comments to the show, download the podcast and discover the vast range of things we discuss and debate on Unbelievable. That's all available at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So there's all sorts of areas I want to open up in the course of today's discussion, gentlemen. I mean, ultimately, this book, Alistair, do you want to just sort of give us the big picture of what you're saying? You're saying that obviously science is a wonderful way of exploring our place in the universe, but that we shouldn't discount the kind of answers that religion and the natural kind of inclination we all have to see something transcendent in the world, that also is a valid way of looking at life as well.
Well, what I'm saying is I used to be a scientist myself. I worked with George Radder in Oxford. In fact, Colin, you succeeded George Radder as the chief executive of the Medical Research Council, if I remember rightly.
That's right.
Yes, I mean, I was wonderful. I loved science, and I still love science. Mm. I think the debate that Colin and I will be having, really, is whether science is it or whether there's something else we need to add on. I mean, I've heard what Colin said, and I think that's right. I'm very happy with that. The question is where we go from there. And in many ways, what this book is doing is saying we need to have this conversation, which is well, I'm so glad we're having this conversation. So let me kind of open this up. Let me take a book, which I mentioned briefly in this. It's Alex Rosen's book, An Atheist Guide to Reality. And it's very, very interesting. And he takes a very strongly physicalist view to things. Now, Colin, I'm not saying you agree with him, okay? I'm just saying that what he says opens up some very good questions for discussion. But as you will know, in that book, he in effect asks questions like this, you know, what is reality? It's limited to what physics can say. What is the meaning of life? There is none. And then, very interestingly, and this I think is something we may well be coming back to, what is the difference between right and wrong, between good and evil? And the answer he gives, based on his own physicalist presupposition, is there is no difference between them. Now, I think he could say science does not give us the intellectual apparatus to say there's any difference between them. But I don't like this absolute statement, there is no difference between them. So I think this could be a very interesting topic of conversation.
Because that presupposes at some level that science is the only valid thing that we have as a tool of explanation in our toolkit.
Well, that would be one element of the conversation. I mean, one of the big debates is whether, in effect, science is the only reliable tool we have to investigate reality, or whether, in effect, there are other things we need to bring into, in effect, saying something like science gives us part of the picture, which I welcome. I want to make it absolutely clear. I have no problem with science. Mm. It's whether, in effect, there is more that needs to be said. And that really is, I think, where the conversation is going to be going today.
I don't know whether you're familiar with Alex Rosen's book and the conclusions he draws there, Colin, but as a physicalist yourself, do you kind of more broadly agree with his take on that?
Well, I broadly agree with his take on it. I'm not sure that I agree with Alistair's interpretation of it completely.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
There's a spin in the words that, of course, reflects Alistair's worldview. I certainly agree with Rosen's general position that the issues that are so often appealed to in defence of religious belief and faith, if one looks at them more deeply, reduced to questionable issues, questionable questions, whether they're genuinely questions that have answers. I mean, I'm sure we'll get to this later in our discussion, but in particular, the issue of right and wrong and good and evil, they matter enormously to us, of course. Actually, in a sense, they matter to all animals. All animals have to live by some kind of conventions of what works and what doesn't, what's correct behavior, what's incorrect behavior. We've translated that general biological inclination into a set of rich language and conventions and cultures in our society, which lead us, perhaps falsely, to believe that there is an absolute thing. I mean, a concept of evil and good, or of right and of wrong, which need to be explained. There are bits of behavior that, to an external observer, could be described as being good for that species, that particular set of animals or whatever. But is there goodness in general hanging around in the universe, like there's gravity in the universe or there's light in the universe? I'm a bit doubtful about that. Actually, I think that was probably closer to Rosen's position on that important issue.
Do you think then that religion ultimately simply isn't a valid enterprise as far as searching for meaning, that if we're going to talk about...
What I worry about is that it tackles questions that I don't see as being valid questions. It's predicated on a vocabulary, rich vocabulary, traditional vocabulary of words like meaning and transcendence and you know, inquiry and good and so on. And I think we need to look at those words very, very carefully before we conclude that there's a major mass of ignorance about the world and ourselves and the universe, which science is incapable of tackling and religion does a good job of.
Alistair?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say religion does a good job on this, but I think that the issues are there. I think that the point I'm trying to make is that science, in effect, which I respect enormously, has difficulty in dealing with questions like what is good, what is evil. I've read Sam Harris's book, The Moral Landscape, and I have to say it is deeply dissatisfying. And I find myself wanting to know how we are able to respect what science is very, very good at, and then, in effect, bring to bear on it the kind of questions that our culture regards as being really important, like what is good or what is evil. And I'm not imposing on you what Alex Rosenberg has to say, but the point is he is saying science, in effect, is not engaging those questions. And I can see that, but I'm saying we are as human beings, and therefore we do need to have some way of beginning to engage these questions. I would never, for example, say that you need to believe in God to be moral, because we can, in effect, choose whatever we like to be moral, but there is this question of how you stabilize moral notions. In other words, say this is defensible, this is actually grounded in something deeper than us. And in the book, one of the things I try and do is look at a number of dialogue partners. For example, Richard Dawkins and Iris Murdoch, just to mention two very obvious ones, of course, Rosenberg as well. And I think that the question I'm wanting to explore is how can we, in effect, recognize what is good about science, and there is much, but at the same time saying maybe as human beings we need more than this if we're going to live authentic, meaningful lives. In other words, is science wonderful cognitively, but does it deliver what we need existentially? And that seems to me to be a very important question to put on the table and open up for further discussion.
Do you think science can, you know, give us existential satisfaction, meaning in that sense? Is it the kind of tool that delivers that, in your view, Colin?
Well, I mean, science is not going to tell us what goodness is, what being good is. It's not going to tell us, it's not going to identify what is evil, but it can tackle the question of why or how or for what purpose, in a biological sense, individuals have those concepts, why societies develop such concepts, why the concepts have a bit of fuzziness from group to group amongst human beings. Not every human group defines evil in quite the same way or considers all exactly the same acts to be sinful. So already we're into a dimension of a variable interpretation. So there's nothing absolute about human beings and the way they live, which suggests that there are absolutely fixed moral codes. Moral codes are patterns of behavior adopted by human beings because they work for that group. And that's the form of explanation, if you like, for the behavior that would satisfy me more, and I'm not saying in any sense that such a trivial statement is a full account, but satisfy me more than invoking the existence, as it were, of absolute forces of good and evil in the world, of rightness and wrongness, of concepts of sin, of words which don't necessarily translate into substance or into problems that need to be defined and tackled.
Yeah, was it Napoleon who said, I have no need of that hypothesis, or someone else, I can't remember now.
But
it seems arrogant, but it's actually an idea that all of us have to deal with every day in our ordinary lives. When we look at any phenomenon that happens to us, like, I don't know, a car passing by or something, is this a phenomenon that I need to have an explanation of? And we're seeking explanations for the things that happen around us all the time. And all I'm saying is that some of them aren't phenomena that actually need to be explained, or indeed can be explained, or are worthy of explanation. And maybe our concepts, which are important to us, we're the kinds of animals for which such concepts as right and wrong are very dear. Whether they are phenomena that need to be explained in those terms or simply considered as part of our patterns of behaviour with respect to each other.
Well, I guess there's always going to be this broader context. I think it's very right to discuss this. But I think that one of the things that C.S. Lewis brought out in that very interesting book, The Abolition of Man, written during the Second World War, was that the kinds of approaches that were around at the time, which mirror what Colin is saying today, in effect deprive us of the value, the vocabulary of evil, to address things like what was happening in Nazi Germany. And again, I think Colin and I have got a very interesting delineation between us here, because what I'm really saying is, I'm very, very open to scientific explanation, but as human beings, we need more than this. And I fully take the point about local instantiations, variations, about moral principles, but nevertheless, there is this deep sense that there is some, again, I go back to Crystal Park's way of thinking, global patterns of meaning, which then embody themselves in local patterns of meaning in different ways in different situations. And I think that is really, for me, the issue that is beginning to emerge as being very significant. And there are loads of philosophers of science who have opened up this question for discussion. Mm. And I don't ascribe ultimately to what they're saying, but one point is that it's one thing to know how things work, but we need to know how to behave, what to do. And that seems to require a bigger vision of things than science is able to offer.
I mean, you're being very polite, both of you, but do you think that Colin's view is reductionistic in that sense, if he's saying that it can all be explained by the mechanics of social evolution and everything else, that isn't for you the kind of explanation people are actually looking for when they ask these why questions?
Well, science is very good at reducing things. I mean, it has to. I mean, what you're trying to do is to find out if there's some basic patterns or basic elements or basic fields that in effect underlie what we observe in the world around us. And I think one of the things science is very, very good at doing is trying to strip things down to what is basic so we can understand what's going on. But the difficulty is, that we have this phenomenon of emergence where things arise at higher levels that can't be predicted at lower levels. And the real thing I'm talking about is, I suppose, this human sense of existential significance of things like meaning and value. And what I'm wondering is whether, in effect, science is very, very good at answering those how questions, but there are these deeper human questions about why. Now, Colin may well want to say that those questions about why are not necessarily invalid, but are misplaced, perhaps. And I think that would be a very good conversation to have. For me, it's human to ask these questions. And therefore, we've got to try and figure out how we engage with human beings as they actually are to address questions of meaning and morality, because we've got to persuade them that there are certain things that they ought to be doing.
Is science enough, then, as far as you're concerned, for doing that, Colin?
Yes, Alistair. I think was intending to parody my position by suggesting that I would just dismiss why questions, but I'm afraid I'm in that category. Let me be frank. I'm a rather old-fashioned reductionist, because that approach has worked so well, and with a lot of sophistication and nuance, of course, in explaining previously deeply puzzling phenomena and properties of the universe. Indeed, properties so puzzling that the only kind of folk explanations that we had were generally in terms of religious explanations, supernatural, if you like, supernatural, above the natural world explanations. It's a very unsatisfactory starting point for an attempt at a scientific analysis of any problem. And again, I'm trying not to be arrogant and to say that these things aren't worth worrying about. Science has explained them all. Absolutely not. I mean, the more science we do, the more questions we discover there are to answer. The universe is an extremely complicated place, but my God, you know, science has done wonderfully well so far in tackling some immensely difficult problems, which we would never have been able to explain in the way that we can now, merely by appealing to faith.
Let's pick that up in the next section of today's programme. We're talking about science, God, and whether either or both can explain the quest for human meaning. That's the question at the centre of Alistair McGrath's new book, The Great Mystery, Science, God, and the Human Quest for Meaning. Having a great conversation today with distinguished scientist Colin Blakemore, Professor of Neuroscience and Philosophy in the School of Advanced Study, University of London, and, of course, a well-known champion of the public understanding of science, especially around neuroscience and the brain. We're going to be continuing this conversation, and let me remind you can also win one of two signed copies of Alistair's book, The Great Mystery, by emailing me or tweeting or Facebooking me with your answer to that question, what is the meaning of life? Do it in 140 characters or less, and we will pick a winner out in a couple of weeks' time. But if you want to email in, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. I'll make sure the other ways of getting in touch are repeated later on in the programme. You're listening to Unbelievable.
Hello and welcome to the programme that brings Christians and non-Christians together with me, Justin Brierley.
For over 10 years as host of Unbelievable, I've listened to objections to faith from the world's leading sceptics. And the most common question I get is, how come you still believe? Unbelievable, the book, is my answer. Telling the story of the show and drawing on hundreds of conversations with atheists and Christians, I explain why I still believe Jesus is the answer to life's deepest questions. Get your copy of Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian, at unbelievablebook.co.uk.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to today's edition of the programme, having a really interesting chat on science, God, and whether either or both can explain the quest for human meaning. And Alistair McGrath's new book, The Great Mystery, draws on both religion and science to explore that question. He's the Andreas Idrios Professor of Science and Religion at Oxford University. As a former atheist biologist turned Christian theologian, he sees God and science as very much complementary rather than competing explanations for our existence and for meaning. And and joining us also is Colin Blakemore, Professor of Neuroscience and Philosophy, and also an author in his own right. I'll come back to you first of all, Colin, because in many ways I think a lot of what you've been saying is summed up in an article you wrote for The Guardian website a few years ago. And I'll just quote from some of the conclusion of that. You mention a discussion along these lines, actually, that you had with Richard Harris in Oxford, a former bishop of Oxford there. And you say he said it would not be surprising if God had created us with a physical facility for belief. And I'll just quote at length, actually, from the rest of this. You say, but there is another interpretation which might eventually lead to the completion of the scientific harvest. Human beings are supremely social animals. We recognize people and judge their feelings and intentions from their expressions and actions. Our thoughts about ourselves and the words we use to describe those thoughts are infused with wishes and wants. We feel that we are the helmsman of our actions, free to choose, even to sin. But increasingly, those who study the human brain see our experiences, even our own intentions, as being an illusory commentary on what our brains have already decided to do. Perhaps we humans come with a false model of ourselves, which works well as a means of predicting the behaviour of other people, a belief that actions are the result of conscious intentions. Then could the pervasive human belief in supernatural forces and spiritual agents controlling the physical world and influencing our moral judgments be an extension of that false logic, a misconception no more significant than a visual illusion? I'm dubious about those why questions. Why are we here? Why do we have a sense of right and wrong? Either they make no sense or they can be recast as the kind of how questions that science answers so well. When we understand how our brains generate religious ideas and what the Darwinian adaptive value of such brain processes is, what will be left for religion? I mean, do you still by and large stand by that casting of the argument in that article?
That's not bad, actually. I haven't reread that passage for a long time. I think I would stick by that, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a bit rhetorical, but yeah, that's pretty much where I stand.
And so the only questions worth answering are ones that science can answer in that sense. Again, I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Well, about worth is one of those loaded words, isn't it? I would say the only questions that can be answered, at least within our present understanding of what it is to answer a question, are questions that can be tackled through science. And you have to, if a question is posed that would lead you simply to say, well, there's no way that we can approach that. There's no way of having an understanding in terms of mechanism for that phenomenon. Then one has to, I think, turn back on the question itself and say, well, is there something wrong with the question? And by the way, that's often happened, of course, in the history of science. The wrong questions have been asked about mechanism, and when the question has been reframed, the answer has been immediately much more obvious.
My response to what you write there, though, and I don't know how far you go down this route, but that obviously many in neuroscience are talking about the idea that, you know, free will doesn't really exist. I know Sam Harris basically takes that view and others. And at that level, we do become very much a sort of, the whole question of meaning, you know, it becomes an illusion at that level, because we're not even choosing the thoughts we're thinking at some level about that question, you know.
What's the we in this?
Yes.
Some mechanism is choosing the direction of our thoughts and the direction of our decision-making and the direction of our action, and it's a complex process, no doubt about that at all. To ask immediately, well, is that free? Is that me? I mean, why? You know, I'm making these decisions. Why does it feel the way that it does? If you're telling me that I'm just a robot, a lot of this has to do with language. I mean, what is we? What is I? What is choose? These are words that our brains produce out of our mouths as a way of communicating with others about how we are behaving. They work well enough for that purpose. Language is a vehicle of getting across between individuals information about the states of mind and the likelihood of action of other people, and that works well enough. Language might not be, indeed it would be very surprising if it were, an accurate description of how brains actually compute and work and determine our behaviour.
Well, let me bring Alistair in.
I think it would be very useful if we could have a little discussion about the kinds of experiments that have led some neuroscientists to question the notion of freedom of will. And what they're really doing is questioning the notion of will, questioning the notion of what freedom means. But it would be useful. Yeah. And I would guess that many of them will be, this sort of approach will be known to many of your listeners. It's almost apocryphal now. You know, but the general approach is to ask people to decide to do some incredibly, ludicrously simple act like pushing a button, and to look at a stopwatch or something and note the exact time as the hands are spinning by when they made that decision themselves, voluntarily, not instructed by some other signal. They just decided to do it. And also, of course, the moment that the button is pressed, it can also easily be recorded. Well, if at the same time you look at activity going on in their brains with electrodes on their heads or with a brain scanner, the general finding is that there's stuff happening in their brain which precedes not only the button press. It'd be pretty remarkable if it didn't, because brains make fingers move and muscles work, but also precedes the feeling that a decision's been made.
Yes.
So a lot of people have immediately leapt to the conclusion, oh my goodness, this completely eliminates the notion of freedom. I think the more interesting and typically more humorous interpretation comes from Dan Dennett, who said, how could it be otherwise? I mean, that would be really, really remarkable if we had thoughts and made decisions in whatever the world of consciousness is. And afterwards, our brains began to respond to those thoughts and carry out actions.
The thoughts somehow preceded the physical thing going on.
Exactly. Right. I mean, that would be really surprising. And as Dennett says, the fact that brain activity precedes our knowledge, as it were, of that brain activity doesn't settle the question of whether the decision is free in a kind of focused psychology sense.
Let me come back to Alistair. Matt Alistair, you're not a neuroscientist, but I'm sure you're perhaps somewhat familiar with this research and so on. Do you have any reflections on whether that has anything to say about what we are and our nature?
Collins rightly pointed out there's a real issue of language here. I mean, we use phrases like freedom or free will, and actually we're trying to articulate something which is actually extremely complex. And I think that Collins making some very important points here about how we do this. I think for me the real issue is whether Collins is right in saying that in effect every question, if properly formulated, is a scientific question. Mm. In other words, one which can be answered in scientific terms. And I respect that position enormously, but I do have to say I think that it is inadequate, that there is more that needs to be said. And that really is the gist of this book. Mm. But if I can put it like this, I think that there are issues here which do open up things. And we could talk about something which I think might be really interesting here, and that is, we've mentioned already the word humanism. I think that's very important, because humanism is not a neutral notion. Humanism is based on an understanding of what human beings are and what human beings need in order to be flourished. And hence, I'm going to be very controversial. I would say I see no difficulty in talking about Christian humanism, which in effect is based on a Christian understanding of what it is that brings us as human beings to fulfillment. But I would fully understand that there would be a secular version of that, which I think nowadays just calls itself humanism, but really is secular humanism. Mm. It's not like what you find with Erasmus of Rotterdam, for example. Sure. And both of these articulate different visions of human nature. My question is, how would we decide which of those visions of human nature is right?
And I know that you're a distinguished patron of the British Humanist Association, Colin. I mean, what for you defines the nature of a human? Is it essentially a biological definition that you would use to define what is a human?
Well, just to follow Alistair's point, I was with you all the way, Alistair, until the last word. And the big question you posed, of course, was how do we know what's right? I just go back to the point I made before. To think of that as a question implies that you have an you believe that there are absolute standards of right and wrong. And I would say what's sort of right in those terms, although I wouldn't use that word, is what is communally accepted amongst a particular group of human beings, which has been worked out by conventions and codes and captured in the law and the way that society and the rules of behavior are constructed. That's right for that group. It doesn't mean that it's preordained, that it's defined from above or something. It can be different in different communities, and there are these nuances in social customs and behavior. And well, you know, does that mean that rightness is different for different groups? So I think what humanism sets out to do is to identify with a broadly accepted convention of social behavior, dependence on each other, which with the hindsight of history has proved most positive and valuable in the construction of strong societies. That's what it's about, respecting individual human beings, recognizing, you know, equality, all those sort of good Western democratic principles are captured in humanism. And as Alistair says, a lot of them map remarkably well onto broad, at least as I understand it, Christian principles. Not all religions maybe, but Christian principles. Well, that's fine. I mean, what that presumably means is that Christianity, in a sense, has identified with codes and patterns of behavior that, as I hesitate to say, but, you know, biology discovered for us long ago.
Right. The things that we would call
evil, the things that we would call sins, are things that you know, aren't adaptive in a biological sense.
In that sense, it is reducible to the evolutionary advantages that come with, you know, treating each other well and so on. But these are things we've invented. They're not things that exist out there. This is the old sort of objective versus subjective morality kind of question here, Alistair. And I guess, yeah, the question from Colin is why would you assume that there is some greater meaning, right and wrong, good and evil, beyond simply the way that we've co-opted it for our own sort of advantage and survival, really?
Well, I think one of the questions that we need to open up here is simply whether we are saying that the process which happened within nature determined what we think to be. Again, I accept the quotation marks, to put a word around these words, but good, bad, whatever it is, or whether there is something beyond us which might actually be something deeper within the universe itself, which actually helps us to say this is right, this is wrong. And I hear what Colin is saying. I very much go along with him, but let me reflect back a question here. I'll just speak about a few minutes, and I'm sure Colin will want to pick this up. I mean, I have many friends who are humanists, although I think they mean by that term secular humanists, who say that religion is, and they would use moral language. It is wrong. It is, some would go further, say it is evil. My view is that religion is natural, that in effect, the cognitive science of religion is just saying that this is actually the very natural way human beings go. And so I'm puzzled by this. It seems to me to introduce some moral vocabulary into what is, in effect, a sort of empirical discussion. And so I'd really be very interested to hear what Colin has to say about that, because it has puzzled me. It may puzzle some of your listeners as well, and be very nice to know what the response is.
Do you believe religion is wrong or evil at any level, Colin?
It's absolutely undeniable that differences in religious belief have been at the source of a lot of conflict in history, but that's not to say that the notion of having religious beliefs, wanting a moral code and so on, doesn't work. And I actually, as a cognitive neuroscientist, the phenomenon of religious belief is undeniable. It's as widespread amongst human beings as language is, and we wouldn't say that language isn't a phenomenon worth inquiry and worth attempting to give an account of. So I think that religious belief and the desire to have explanations for phenomena that are not currently explained is deep in human beings. It's our curiosity about the world. It's a good feature of human beings. I would just say that, maybe we should ask whether religion is really necessary to achieve it, given the success of science in pursuing the same theme.
And would you, in a sense, I think atheist scientists have, said they would like to see scientific understanding replace wholesale religious understandings. Is that something you think should happen, you'd like to see happen?
Well, I'd qualify that. I wouldn't like to see a world in which free rein is given to behavior, attitudes, concerns and lacks of concern, simply because people abandon their belief in some broader concept of morality. There's a very interesting observation. Again, referring back to the work on the illusion of free will, so to speak, there's an experiment in which people were... You can give people good tests of their attitudes towards others, their willingness to cooperate with others, their concern and empathy with others, and so on, in a kind of laboratory setting, in simple tests, right? That's the starting point for this experiment. Now, it turns out that if you tell people before such experiments, such tests of behavior, eminent scientists, including Francis Crick, I'm trying to remember the words, have accepted that our feeling of free will is in fact an illusion, and that we are not responsible in that sense for our actions. So they simply read a statement. And then they do these very simple laboratory tests where pictures flash on the screen, they have to press a button to say how they would respond, and their attitudes shift. They become less sympathetic, less cooperative, less altruistic in their attitudes on discovering that some eminent scientists have said that free will is an illusion. I think we have to be concerned about such things, that science can be abused and misused. That's quite clear. We see many examples of that in the past.
Let me bring Alistair in again.
Be careful about the abuse, the the trivialization, the misinterpretation, and the abuse of yeah. research.
Alistair, do you want to?
Well, I'll come in here because I think Colin's opened up a really interesting area, and it's one that I know many of your listeners want to talk about, and that is the abuse of science. And again, I want to reiterate, you know, I love science, and there's nothing a lover is more wounded by than the abuse of that. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that really troubles me is the way in which we as human beings abuse science. And the example I give in the book, I mean, it's a very predictable example, but it is the eugenics debate of the 1920s, when here in Britain, you know, prominent people who saw themselves being liberal and progressive, you know, right on, in effect, went in for a kind of abuse of Darwinism, which said, now that we understand how, in effect, evolution happens, we can take control of the process. And so, I mean, you know, you have this horrible notion of sterilization of certain people groups, prevention of certain people groups from procreating and so on. And it just seems to me that part of one of my reflections about human nature in this book is that we seem awfully good at taking something that is either neutral or even good and doing something thoroughly awful with it. In other words, there has to be some kind of moral framework within which we do things. And for me, the eugenics debate is very much about science, in effect, being used in a way, and I would use the word immoral. But I have to say immediately that, you know, we have to have a debate about language yes. here. But nevertheless, looking back on it now, we would say, why did we ever think of doing that? Mm. And what principles do we bring to bear other than, for example, social utility?
And in that sense, for you, science is not the tool we use to answer that ethical question of, because obviously science in that sense is neutral. You can do eugenics with science if you want to simply create a certain type of person, you know, rather than the and so on. And your view is that actually we need religion, we need God to be able to answer the deeper questions about what it means to be human, what it means
even at a very minimalist level, I think we need to be able to say this is not right. Perhaps go stronger. This is wrong. Perhaps even go stronger and say, you know, this might be evil. But the point is that you know, science operates in an environment. Yeah. And my concern here is, I think it was being abused here. And my question is, how do we bring a framework to bear which allows us to say this is an abuse?
I mean, thought experiment for you, Colin, at this point. Let's say that the Nazis had won and that we were still doing eugenics today in the way that they sort of wanted to see practiced. I mean, if that just was the way we had adapted as a society and the way we thought we should go about things, would that just be the way it is? Because there isn't ultimately, you know, an objective morality out there. It's just the way we work things out together as a society, or is it not that simple?
I think that's an interesting question. I think that's a very interesting question. Although, of course, I'm appalled by the atrocities that were done by fascist regimes, you have to look at the fact that there was compliance and general commitment by a large fraction of the nations that were involved in such things. There was a kind of corporate agreement to the sorts of principles, horrendous though they are as we see them.
But they didn't see them as horrendous as we obviously see them now. I guess that's
the time not, and you know, at every stage we have to examine. We can't just look with the eye of history and say, oh my God, the terrible things that were done in this country in the medieval times or by the Nazis in Germany in the 30s, 40s were horrendous, and we've got it all right now. I mean, we can be pretty sure that people will be looking back in the future and saying, well, you know, that the system that they operated with and found to be satisfactory, in other words, right to them, is not right to us. That's what I mean by saying that the definition of right is a movable feast. Now, is their right in the future, how they define what's right, better somehow than our right now? Is our definition of right now better than people with other religious beliefs or other social conventions?
I suppose the question I'm sort of asking is, if you went into a time machine back to, you know, Goebbels or whoever and were to try and persuade them that what they were doing was wrong, what would stop them, I suppose, simply saying to you, well, I think it's right, so, you know, we just have a different opinion on this?
Well, they would have done, of course, and thank goodness, you know, and the kind of turmoil of seeking a suitable society, which is what life is about for human beings in the long run. Fortunately, their attitude was overturned. But for a while, for a very large number of people, it prevailed.
It was the prevailing view.
It was the prevailing view. By the way, can I say, I mean, Alistair, I don't know your views on gene editing. You'll know that approach to eugenics, but of course no one would use the word these days, but you know, the underlying principle is a very similar one. The notion that we can tackle horrific familial diseases now with what one hopes very little risk, and with the opportunity to eliminate from families that have suffered in perpetuity from the presence of a genetic disorder, eliminate that problem. Now, what do you think of that?
I think, Colin, this is a wonderful development. I'm all for medical advance. It is a very Christian thing to do. The one thing I would say, though, it's a cautionary note.
How is it different in principle?
Well, it's a cautionary note. Let me just make this point, and then we can come back to this. The point I want to make is: are we sure that by doing this, we aren't introducing new factors which might come back and bite us in a generation's time? In other words, the question is, in making such changes, are we unintentionally and inadvertently, like the laws of unintended consequences, doing something which might, in effect, in future, be seen to have been a false step? That is my concern. It's a purely scientific concern. Are we, in effect, by making such changes inadvertently, because we cannot actually know how this figures out in the long term, opening the door to something that might in effect be irreversible? So that it's a sort of cautionary concern.
Yeah, well, that sounds to me like an empirical question, not a religious one.
Well,
you're saying
times
if we eliminated some genetic variant on the basis of current arguments, it's actually a bad thing to have it. We might discover in the future, oh gosh, we've lost a whole bunch of useful human beings because they had other special characteristics. But that doesn't seem to be to a religious argument.
But you're assuming there's a kind sort of box marked religion, a box marked science, and so on. These things interact. Well, that's the whole argument of my book, that in effect, good religion is engaging with science, good science is engaging with religion. It gives a deeper and richer picture of things.
I mean, your view here, Colin, seems to be that the modern equivalent of eugenics is gene editing. I suppose the difference is, the obvious difference is that eugenics was dealing with humans, you know, sterilising them, doing those sorts of things to stop particular traits occurring, and in that sense had in mind what a perfect human might be. Gene editing, I suppose, begins a lot further back in the process,
and has different definitions of what perfection is. Mm. I mean, if you belong to a family carrying a gene for Huntington's disease, and it has damaged individuals generation after generation and killed individuals generation after generation in your family, the gene's been identified. If there were a mechanism for removing it from the germline so that your family in future was spared from that horrific condition, well, I think most people would be interested in that. They would ask questions about the risk to individuals, the possibility of something going wrong. Of course they would. And we as a society ought to as well, because we would live with the consequences. But in principle, gosh, wouldn't it be good if one could eliminate that suffering? Those are different targets from what Nazis had in mind. But the principle of modifying people in perpetuity, I mean, eliminating from the world people with Huntington's disease, well, in principle, is it different from eliminating from the world people with characteristics that Nazis didn't like?
Yes.
I mean, it's a really interesting question.
And I suppose the question is, Alistair,
and many, of course, would argue that it's a slippery slope, that what I guess, medical issues now, maybe wouldn't have been in the past if we medicalize the kinds of
We're going to go to a break, but I'd like to come back to it, because in a sense I think that's kind of at the centre of your book, about whether science alone can offer the answers to the kinds of moral and ethical questions.
And raising this question of transhumanism, the technological modification
indeed
of humanity.
Yeah, that you cover
effect,
that.
Deal, I mean, Colin's raised some very interesting questions. It would be lovely to be able to come back to them.
We will. We'll have another 10 minutes or so to get into it. Time always flies on Unbelievable, but that's the sign you're having a good conversation. Can science, God, or both explain the quest for human meaning? Our question today, Alistair McGrath and Colin Blakemore are my guests. Come back again for the final part of today's discussion.
If you want to have a massive reason why human beings are special, here it is. God became one.
We can be part of God's plan to bring hope to a hopeless generation.
We're living in an exciting time to be a follower of Jesus, the golden age of Christianity, ladies and gentlemen.
We live in a universe that has a story that is ultimately about love.
There's a God-shaped hole in the heart of every person. It can only be filled by God, made known through Jesus Christ.
Hear the world's leading Christian thinkers make the case for Christ at Unbelievable, the Conference 2017. Now available not only on DVD, but also as a digital download. Order online at premier.org.uk/shop.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley, and this is the show that brings you conversations that matter every Saturday afternoon and, of course, wherever you are in the world via podcast at a time convenient to you. If you want to find more resources, the podcast and much more besides, do check out the show's webpage at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And you may have already heard that Unbelievable, the conference from this year, took place on May the 13th, now available on DVD and CD. You can find that at premier.org.uk/shop. And indeed, you can download the digital version of that wherever you are in the world and avoid the postage costs. So premier.org.uk/shop got some really amazing speakers and seminars from this year's conference. Of course, Unbelievable, the book is also available. I did mention earlier that it went to its first reprint this last week, which is great news. Great to know that it is reaching lots of people, being picked up in bookshops and via Amazon and elsewhere, including our own website, unbelievablebook.co.uk. But it's time to announce the winners of the competition that I announced a few weeks ago, where I encouraged you to email in order to win one of five signed copies of the book. We put all your names in a virtual hat, and I've picked out five of them. I also asked people if they're willing to leave me a comment on why they enjoy the Unbelievable show. So well done to Isaac Munoz Moreno, who is one of the winners, says, "I just recently started listening to the podcast when Josh McDowell recommended it on his blog. I enjoy listening to it. It gives me tools to respond to questions from my colleagues and family, encourage me to share the gospel because you also do it. And I enjoy seeing God being glorified through these discussions, even if there's not always a panelist winner. Thanks for your efforts." Thank you, Isaac. Paul Hildreth also wins a copy. He says he enjoys the show because faith in Jesus is not blind but reasonable. Anything that demonstrates that as well as Unbelievable should be heard by everyone. Marty Johnson says, "I've been an avid Unbelievable listener for over 10 years. I'm constantly encouraged and challenged in my faith because of it. I cannot count how many times a certain episode will send me back to Scripture to scratch an itch in my brain or heart due to what was said on either side of the table." Cole Seligman also wins, says, "I recently came across Unbelievable and have thoroughly enjoyed listening to several of the podcast episodes. Really enjoy hearing both sides of certain topics and being able to reason and think of how I would respond to objections to the Christian faith. There's not another podcast like it. Keep up the great work, Justin." And finally, David Sexton is also a winner. Didn't leave a comment, but still gets a book. So well done, all five of you, winners of signed copies of Unbelievable, the book. And commiserations to all those who entered but didn't get drawn out. You can, of course, get yourself a copy nonetheless by going to the website unbelievablebook.co.uk. It is the story of the show and why, after 10 years of talking with atheists, I'm still a Christian. It's my case for Christian faith, and I look forward to hearing what you make of it. I always enjoy hearing your emails and reading them out once you've read the book. And indeed, do feel free to leave a review on the Amazon websites as well. I understand, a good way of making sure people see the book on the Amazon site when they're browsing, if you can leave a review. Still to come, George Verwer, straight after Unbelievable today. I'll be talking to him, founder of Operation Mobilization, extraordinary individual with a massive vision and heart, still going strong today. And you'll be hearing about his life, faith, conversion, and some of the challenges he's faced in his life, including a struggle, lifelong struggle with pornography, actually. So listen out for that between 4 and 5 this afternoon. Available, of course, as a podcast as well. One of a number of podcasts you can find from the Premier Christian Radio stable. Next week on the show, if you can come back, David Hutchings and Professor Tom McLeish, both into physics and Christians at that, are authors of Let There Be Science, Why God Loves Science, and Science Needs God. They're going to be in conversation with Oxford physicist and agnostic Susie Sheehy. That will be a really, really good episode, I can promise you. So come back for that, as a second scientifically related show for you. We've got more of your feedback to come in a moment's time, but right now let's finish up this discussion on God, science, and meaning.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, in the final part of today's discussion, we're just concluding the conversation between Alistair McGrath and Colin Blakemore. Very much a question on the relationship between science and religion, and whether we need both to explain human meaning, purpose, good and evil, and all that sort of thing. All of these themes tackled in Alistair's new book, The Great Mystery, Science, God and the Human Quest for Meaning. Just another final reminder that two signed copies of Alistair's book available to be given away on the programme today. So if you would like to send me your answer to the question, what is the meaning of life, in 140 characters or less, you can tweet that to me at UnbelievableJB, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB to send it to me via Facebook, or indeed email me your answer, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And I look forward to hearing your answers, and in a couple of weeks' time we'll choose the winners at random from the ones that have come in. I won't expect you to have necessarily come up with a definitive answer. Colin Blakemore, well known as a champion of public understanding of science, he's a professor of neuroscience himself, author of books such as The Mind Machine. And we've been asking what he makes of Alistair's attempted synthesis of science and religion in this quest for human meaning. Okay, I've been asking the listeners for this question, but if someone asked you, let's start with you, Colin, what is the meaning of life, Colin Blakemore, what might you hazard as an answer to that?
I would be puzzled at the question, of course, I'm afraid. Mm. I'd say, what do you mean by meaning? It implies that there's some kind of external arbiter of whether a life has worked or not. I mean, we have plenty of objective criteria for how people are behaving, whether they've been successful in one way or another, productive in one way or another, valuable to society in one way or another. Isn't that enough without saying, okay. Yes, but then what does it all mean? Why are we here? Why are we here is a question that, because often, I often face, and I find the question very difficult to understand. I mean, there isn't a why. There isn't a why for how we're here. There isn't a why, any more than there's a why for a butterfly or a leaf.
And so would your answer effectively be, there is no meaning?
Yes.
Yeah, and but then if you ask the sort of a question with maybe a more subjective element, what gives you meaning in life, Colin? What would your answer be then?
The things that for me produce a sense of reward and satisfaction and a feeling of pleasure and achievement and fit my own codes of behavior and action, my own criteria of success and failure. I mean, those are the things that determine how I feel about how life is. And I don't have to refer to some other arbitrary metric of whether life's good or bad and whether it's failed or been successful, whether it means something.
Isn't, though, in a sense, if we're all dependent on our own subjective meanings, that's also arbitrary at some level, you know. We might all come to very different conclusions about
it's all individual. I wouldn't say arbitrary. It's all individual. It depends on the rich intermix of the kind of makeup we have biologically and the way in which we have been affected and changed biologically by our experiences, by our culture, by our memories, by our past successes and failures. I mean, we are continuously evolving instruments of judgment, and including self-judgment. We set our own criteria dependent on how we've been born and constructed and how we change throughout our lives.
Don't
underestimate the richness of the biology of people, and don't resort to to non-explanations based on supernatural concepts. Don't doubt science is what I would say.
don't doubt science. It sounds a little bit like you're putting your faith in a sense at some level in that as the explanatory framework. But
absolutely. Yeah, if you walk into any scientist who walks into a laboratory to do an experiment has faith that the methodology that they're using, the principles, the belief that there's cause and action, that there are regularities and rules and forces and characteristics that operate in the universe that are the same tomorrow as they are today. I mean, that's faith, if you like. Yeah. But it's just, you know, faith in the way that the universe works as it is revealed to us by science.
I'm sure there's lots you want to comment on there, Alistair, but before you do that, again, if I were to simply ask you that question, what is the meaning of life? What would your response be?
Well, my response would be that psychologically, meaning includes questions like identity, purpose, agency, and of course value. In other words, do I matter? Mm. And so what I would say is I would bring to bear on these a bigger framework, a kind of big picture that C.S. Lewis talks about, which seems to me to generate these values and give me a sense of who I am. But it is a pragmatic outcome. It means I want to serve. I have to tell you, I come from a medical family. I'm very sympathetic to everything Colin's been saying. I'm the black sheep. I'm the one who didn't actually go into medicine. But here is the real point, that actually, on the basis of this vision of the meaning of life, that means you want to make the world a better place. That means you want to, in effect, deal with pain, with suffering, all these things. And so it's actually a framework which leads to action. Now, Colin and I think of different frameworks, but actually there might be some overlap of actions there.
Yes.
But Colin, I think, made a point that actually we're all, he talked about being in effect and affected by the rich outcomes of biology. We need also to bring culture into this. And there is a sense in which all of us are shaped by our individual makeups, by the culture in which we are. And the question really for me is whether that means we're determined by those, or whether in effect, in some sense, we're free to choose a way which seems right to us. Mm. And I don't know whether I'm saying I chose a way that in effect was imposed on me, or a way that I chose, but certainly I moved from atheism to Christianity. And that seemed to me to be a free choice at the time, in the sense that I was looking at one option, looking at another option, and in effect saying I choose to make this. I think that one of the really interesting questions that emerged from this is how we make these decisions.
Yeah. You wanted to touch on an area that we've only got a few minutes to do it, really, Colin brought up, but the whole area of what it means to be human. You touch on transhumanism in the book as well, Alistair. I want to give you the chance to
very briefly
conclude
and
those
again,
thoughts.
Again, this is simply something I talk about in the book, which I think is relevant here. I mean, Colin's been talking about gene editing, something which I think is good. I think the question is, where do we go from here? And as you will know, there's a movement called transhumanism, which in effect is saying we can technologically or genetically modify ourselves, so in effect we become able to live for, well, transhumanists say 500 years, which I think is perhaps rather ambitious. But supposing we were,
yes.
I mean, what in God's name happens? I mean, you read Thomas Malthus's Essay on Population. We were living for 500 years. What is going to happen to dwindling food resources? What are the social implications of this? And it just seems to me that we need a broader debate about where we go in the future.
And I suppose that ultimate question of what, why are we so keen to extend our life? For what purpose? I mean, in the sense that it brings us, for me at least, back to that question of meaning and sort of, if you want to live for 500 years, what exactly is that going to do for your life if you're still sort of extinguished at the end of it?
Well, I'm ready to go now. I don't want to live for 500 years. But I mean, it seems to me just a really interesting question of just looking at this very complex interplay of scientific progress, values, whether they be religious or whether they be, you know, more generically derived. It just seems to me it shows us some really interesting conversations here. And in the book, I just say, look, we need to have these conversations. Whether you think religion is right or wrong, it's important. And actually, this can be a very good way of proceeding.
Any final thoughts as we start to draw things to a close from you, Colin?
We just touched on this issue of culture, but I think it's crucially important. Religious belief is a very deep part of our culture, perhaps diminishing in some parts of the world, but you know, it's been a characteristic of human beings, and I think invented by human beings, but probably, since it's so widespread, on the basis of some deep factor in our biological makeup, the need to have explanations. So I think science is the scientific quest has as its origins the same kind of cognitive mechanisms as religion. The question is, are they in some way complementary? Are they compatible? Do they reinforce each other? Those sorts of arguments that Alistair would make. Or is there an inexorable and inevitable replacement of the sorts of explanations that religious supernatural beliefs offered in the past by scientific explanations? Will there be a residuum of ignorance or lack of understanding or concepts that defy explanation for which a faith-based explanation is the only approach? These are big questions, well worth discussing. Yes, we absolutely don't have the answer to them, I agree. But, you know, I sit on the, as you see, sit on the side of the fence that says, look what science has achieved in the past. Let's not underestimate its ability to provide explanations to extremely complex questions.
Thank you so much for joining us on the programme, Colin. It's been a real pleasure and delight to have you on, and hope we can get you back on at some point in the future. Thanks for being with me today.
Well, I've enjoyed it too. Thank you, Alistair.
Thank you, Colin.
Alistair, thanks also for being with us on the programme today. And obviously, I'm sure I'd love to do this again at some point.
Because there's been great conversation.
So many more questions that get raised in the course of having this kind of conversation. Again, The Great Mystery, Science, God and the Human Quest for Meaning, available now from Alistair McGrath. You can find details for both my guests, Colin Blakemore as well, at the website of today's programme, where you can share on the show as well to others. Why not spread the word and get other people listening? All the details available at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Once again, you can get in touch via email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, via social media at UnbelievableJB, on Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. Look forward to hearing your thoughts on today's show, any other feedback you may have, and of course your entries for the competition to win one of two signed copies of Alistair McGrath's new book. And before I forget, actually, we've had a really exciting confirmation of an interview I'm going to be doing very soon with the Templeton Award winner and brilliant Christian philosopher Alvin Plantinga. Now, he's a bit of a legend in the world of Christian philosophy, theology, apologetics and so on. And I'm going to be sitting down with him for an edition of Unbelievable, taking your questions to him, as well as asking him about his own life and faith and winning the Templeton Prize. I'm looking for your questions. Now, if you're listening to this programme on air or soon after it gets released as a podcast, you may just be in time. I need your questions for Alvin Plantinga by Monday, the 24th of July. Okay, Monday, the 24th of July. If you can send me your question, it may have a chance of being read out and put to Alvin himself. We're going to be doing an Ask Alvin Plantinga Anything edition of the programme. Again, send them in to unbelievable@premier.org.uk. I'll ask as many as I can. Submit them by the 24th of July. Thanks to those who've been getting in touch. A couple of these came in on Facebook. Jonathan Sullivan said, really love your programme. I get to hear some of my favourite thinkers and teachers that most of the US is oblivious to, and tons of other fascinating discussions. I think in American Christianity, we've lost the ability to entertain conflicting viewpoints and intelligently discuss our differences. So refreshing to hear good Christian debate. Thank you. And thank you very much, Jonathan. Matt Bond on Facebook says, I heard about your podcast maybe a year ago while listening to the Cross Examined podcast. I listen every week from Denver, Colorado. Enjoy hearing the arguments against Christianity to prepare myself for them when they come up in discussion in my life. Thanks for your mission. I'll be praying for its continued success. God bless. And also Jeremy Beerman. He's been in touch before. He's an atheist out in South Africa. He says, hope you're well. I have ordered your book. I'm sure it's going to be a cracker. Over the years during a show, your erudition concerning all of the technical issues that have arisen during the discussions on the show is quite remarkable. My journey has taken me away from Judaism and gradually towards atheism. Even though I'm only 42, my health has been disastrous since the age of 5. I'm proud to say that I've been an atheist for more than 15 years. As tempting as many people find religion during difficult times or to make sense of tremendous hardship, I think that atheism is a more dignified and noble position. While your book is on the way, just wanted to ask you one burning question that's been in the back of my mind. How do you reconcile the possible cognitive dissonance that some experience when reputable and talented people like John Lennox and Oz Guinness, who are totally convinced there's a God, with others like Sir Roger Penrose, who's immensely talented, and like Steven Weinberg, who claim that the more comprehensible the cosmos becomes, the more pointless it seems? I doubt whether Weinberg is being mischievous in saying this. I have trouble getting my head around how these people can have such divergent views over something that should be pretty clear. Thank you, Jeremy. That's a big question. Why do intelligent people, evidently intelligent people, disagree about some of the most fundamental aspects of our universe and whether there's a meaning and so on behind it? I think it's because they are reading the evidence in very different ways and through very different filters very often, I think, as well. And that's something that I do address in the book as well. So I hope when you do read it, you'll appreciate that and get in touch again about what you make of it. And if it persuades you in any direction at all, I'd be interested to hear as well. But thank you for ordering the book and thank you for getting in touch. So on to some of these emails that came in on the subject of abortion. This was last week's show in which an ex-abortionist, Robinson Haywood, was in discussion with Wendy Savage, a doctor who has carried out over 10,000 abortions in her lifetime. And this one from Robert Hummel on Facebook says, I just listened to the abortion show. Have to give you credit for being a great moderator. I think you did a good job on letting both sides speak. One side was really for the woman's right to choose. The other was fully for the fetus slash baby. I was really curious on what your thoughts are on the subject. I'm assuming you're pro-life, but I can see you also being sympathetic on the woman's rights as well. Great job again, and please keep it up. Well, if you want to know my opinion, I am pro-life. I do believe in the humanity of the unborn child. Having said that, I also believe Christians, if they are pro-life, need to be willing to get their hands dirty in terms of supporting women who are poverty-stricken, who are coming out of circumstances where they might be forced to think about having an abortion. And we need to dig deep and make sure that we're in a society, a culture, where women aren't forced to make desperate choices like abortion. But thank you for getting in touch, Robert. Darren says, why do Christians care so much about abortion when God intentionally designed the human body to abort half of all pregnancies naturally? As Dr. Savage pointed out, half of the fertilized eggs that occur are aborted naturally. So God obviously doesn't care about abortion since he designed the human body to naturally abort half of pregnancies. As a side note, the anti-abortion clinics in the US that Dr. Robinson works for actively lie to their patients. Says Darren. But I had another email from Dr. Claire Walsh saying, I listened to the debate. The question I really want to ask was, where on earth does Dr. Savage get this figure that approximately 50% of fertilized eggs are lost even before the woman misses her first period? Surely the woman herself wouldn't even know that. So how scientists can, I don't know. She glibly uses this fact to justify what she thinks and does. Well, I'm not sure exactly where that figure comes from, but I'm sure someone will be able to make a suggestion. Paul Wright says, as a physician, I found your program, like all of them, well done and civil. This one lacked some of the debating expertise of other guests for other topics. I felt Dr. Savage's calm engagement was good, but her argument to justify abortion, basically that if it was not made medically safe, abortions could kill mothers, that's not arguing for the act of doing an abortion, but against the act of an unsafe abortion. I'm sure that some women have died from sepsis through unsafe and non-medically supervised female genital mutilations, but I don't think Dr. Savage would go to other countries to perform that surgery. Dr. Robinson's kind demeanour was lovely, as you would say, but his running away from some biological, physiological areas with the comment about brown cows eat green grass and produce white milk was a little puerile. But he did bring to light the overwhelming consensus of geneticists and embryologists that life begins at conception. And Dr. Savage could only say she doesn't agree. Nature gets rid of half of them? Well, that doesn't mean they aren't living organisms that are dying. She only brings up the idea of whether there's a spirit involved as a red herring, since she has no desire to believe in a spirit. Again, well done on the programme. Thank you very much. Judith says, I just tuned into this show and was tempted to look at some pictures online of aborted babies just before my meal. I feel sick. I cannot believe that anyone in their right mind could say that this is not a human being, doesn't have feelings and could be justified. The right of the child, the potential child, does matter. Please see sense. This is horrific. I can't believe what I have just seen. Judith, I'm sorry, the disturbing images you obviously went to and looked for. Not something you want to do without some foreknowledge of what you're likely to run into there. Stephen on Facebook says, the programme on abortion was difficult to hear. I had to break it up into sections and come back to it to listen. It made my stomach sick. As I was experiencing this, I reflected on how our emotions are tied to our thoughts and beliefs so intimately. They usually occur without our consciousness. You mentioned how the topic was a highly emotive one. Your pro-abortion guest also noted how rich the English language is. This is very true, and those observations can be tied together. Our language gives way to our thoughts, our perspectives, our emotional experiences, and how they're shaped. It provides our brains a framework for thinking, organising, and interacting with our world. It's very powerful. It also provides groundwork for our defence mechanisms, which are basically the mind's way of defending itself against unpleasant realities, emotions, and trauma. People can develop rather intricate defences, such as a rationalisation, to assist them with processing trauma. But no matter how one perceives the world or views events, an action is still an action. At the end of the day, a doctor and a woman have to ask themselves, am I okay with terminating a human life? No matter how you construct it in your mind, no matter what language you use, that is what's happening. Once the abortion is performed, the life growing inside that mother is gone. There will be no person come from that. It's simple. Action and consequence. Abortion and no life. Is that something a person can live with? Some people have difficulty with that. As a psychologist, I've sat in therapy with some women who have undergone abortions. I've heard their questions. How could I have killed my baby? How can I live with myself? What have I done? They understand action and consequence. They're living it. While they can learn to forgive themselves and find new perspectives to move forward with their lives, they can't change what they've decided. At the end of the day, that's the bottom line. What can a person live with? Just a few of my thoughts. Thank you for all you do, Justin. By the way, loving your book. Well done. Thank you very much, Stephen. This is from A, wants to go by the initial. Abortion is a horrible thing, but I'd like every child to be a wanted child. It's so sad that there are street children in many parts of the world who just have to try to survive on the streets as people don't want them. There are children in Britain who are neglected and abused by their parents who don't want them. If only we could make sure each one of them was loved, wanted and taken good care of. Contraception is the answer, but it's very hard to achieve in all circumstances. Perhaps we Christians shouldn't be so critical of abortion unless we're prepared to adopt unwanted children ourselves. And just a quick one from Ben, who says one of the best talks he ever heard it was by Stephanie Gray, called Abortion from Controversy to Civility at Talks at Google. Well worth watching and getting on your program next time you talk about abortion, he says. And there's many more here. We're going to have to leave them for the moment, though, as we're out of time. Thank you for those. And if you want to continue sending in your thoughts on that program, as I say, it was emotive and at times graphic as well in the descriptions of abortion processes. But it is available to listen back to, of course, at the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Do send your feedback in. Thank you for being with me here on Unbelievable. Coming up next, I'm joined by George Verwer of Operation Mobilisation for The Profile. But let me tell you what's coming up on Unbelievable next week.
You're unbelievable.
David Hutchings and Professor Tom McLeish are authors of Let There Be Science, Why God Loves Science and Science Needs God. They make the case that most of the scientific revolutions and progresses of the last several centuries have been because of Christianity. It's a big claim. They're going to be in conversation with Oxford physicist and agnostic Susie Sheehy about that. Do come back for the show that aims to get you thinking every week here on Premier Christian Radio. Unbelievable.